Hello, what's going on? This is your host, Gabe Lazarus, the Managing Madrid podcast. I'm joined today for your first actual During the World Cup podcast by Arvind Ohm. Happy Father's Day. I mean, I don't think either of us are fathers, but happy Father's Day to Keon, I guess.
Yep, he's taking a day off, so it's just going to be you and me. And I hope that's good enough for you guys who are listening. I'm certainly excited to talk about the World Cup for the first time on this podcast, so let's get going.
Hell yeah, let's do it. I mean, and just at the top of the show, I can't express enough how deeply, deeply morally conflicted I am about the World Cup because, I love the World Cup. This has just been such an incredibly fun couple of days already, and I know it's like a whole month of just nonstop. Every day I get to wake up and watch awesome football. So, like, it's really hard. It's really hard because I'm incredibly conflicted about it.
Yeah, I feel you. I feel you completely. There's on a personal level, I'm enjoying this a lot, but there are very obvious issues here with hosting the World Cup in Russia that we are definitely going to touch on. I don't feel journalism at large has done the greatest job in doing that. So we definitely would have to touch on that today.
Yeah,
we can't ignore. It's part of the World Cup.
Yeah, so we'll get into that later in the show, but there's a reason that we're both feeling very morally conflicted about it. But before that, we get to talk about the actual games, which is going to be a very, very fun, just a quick run-through. So we're recording this on after the games that were played on Sunday. So if you're expecting to hear commentary about any of the games that occurred on Monday, you got your SOL. But up until then, we've got a bunch of awesome stuff to talk about. Lots of Real Madrid important stuff. Obviously, I think the most Real Madrid. And another thing I'm going to do is at the end of this show, I'm going to cut in the little bit about 5 minutes or so. Just in case you're a Managing Madrid podcast listener in England or someone who likes to listen to my shitty analysis, you can pop on. I'm doing work as a Real Madrid and Spain correspondent for Love Sport Radio in London. So I'm gonna drop in some of the audio from that. I talked a little bit about Hierro, a little bit about Cristiano Ronaldo and all that. Obviously, though, I think the first and most important thing as Madrid fans to talk about, we got to talk about Spain-Portugal.
Oh, what a game that was. I think that have been the best World Cup game I've ever watched. I mean, I haven't watched too many World Cups. The first one I watched was the 2010 World Cup. But out of all the games I've watched since then, in my opinion, this was the best one I ever saw on so many levels. Tactically, it was very intriguing. I mean, obviously wasn't up to club level as you would expect, but it was still of high quality for the international stage. You know, they're very interesting tactical battles. The drama was insane. You know, the player performances, the passion of the fans I could feel coming through. It was the World Cup game we all deserved because the ones before that were kind of underwhelming, and I feel like this one really kicked the World Cup off.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of game where if you have American kind of shithead friends who don't understand soccer and talk about how it sucks and is boring, you know, if you make them watch this game and they still say that shit, then, you know, you're never going to convince them literally. Like, this is the definitional soccer game. Like, how do you watch this game and not like this sport? That's my question after all this. And, you know, it's the kind of game where at the end of the match, you know, we actually kind of fall on different sides of who we were rooting for in the match, obviously, because I'm Spanish. I was rooting for La Selección, and you are a Portugal fan. And I think at the end of the match, the feeling from both sides, at least for me, it was like that Portugal felt pretty good about the way the match had ended. Spain was feeling a little bit down. But I think both teams, and especially the Real Madrid players who make up the core of both teams, have a lot to be pleased with after that draw.
Absolutely. I think Spain has a real reason to feel optimistic about their chances in this World Cup, especially after seeing how Germany and Brazil performed in their first games. And obviously a draw is disappointing, but if we're being honest, if De Gea plays how any, you know, normal average goalkeeper would, Portugal aren't winning that game because they simply didn't have enough chances. And if they can avoid facing players that put in GOAT performances, you know, I think they'll be pretty good because that's what it was. It was the combination of a horrible mistake from De Gea and Ronaldo being Ronaldo. And I don't think that combination of factors will occur too many times throughout the tournament for Spain. I mean, I'm not saying obviously they're just going to go on and win now, but what I saw from them on the pitch was extremely impressive. Yeah. So Portugal came out in a very organized fashion, more organized than I'm used to seeing, because I think Portugal's defensive organization tends to be overrated a little bit, but when they played Spain, it was actually very, very good. Obviously, your usual compact 4-4-2 block in the middle of the pitch, looking to cut out all spaces, and what Portugal did was they man-marked Spain's midfielders with their four across the middle and let Busquets drop in between the CBs and didn't bother him. So they were really good in the first 10 minutes or so of blocking off all the passing lanes, and putting pressure on all the playmakers. And Spain, after a while, they just began to figure it out on the fly. And that's what's most impressive, to break down an organized defensive block and struggle at first and then figure out how to get past it. That is an invaluable tactic, especially in international football. And Spain did it by putting extreme emphasis on the left wing. So everyone started to rotate to that, to exploit Portugal's man-marking tactics and essentially overload the left. So you had David Silva moving all the way over from the right wing into the left half space. You had Koke coming from over there. You had Diego Costa running into the left channel. And so Portugal's midfielders on their left side couldn't come over and track those players because it would have ruined their shape. So Spain essentially had free rein through the left. The combination play was excellent. And there were several times where they were pretty unlucky, where they didn't get a shot off or the shot just missed a post or something like that. And the way they just solved it on the fly, you just felt it was not that Portugal was playing badly. It was just that Spain was too good. And that's kind of best thing you can say about a team. At the end of the day, it was Ronaldo that saved Portugal. And I guess that's why Portugal can also feel good, because they put in a competent performance, and that's what the most they can do. And they have to hope Ronaldo can take them over the line. And if Ronaldo is in the kind of form, you have to feel good about
it. You do. I was thinking during the match about how you're watching this Spain team that really was executing all of the, you know, all the things that Spain was worried about, right, going into this match. They executed, right? They had goal scoring. Diego Costa actually put in a performance that he's never put in for Spain before. This was the kind of vintage Costa performance, really playing as that not target man nine, the back to the goal, kind of holding the ball, distributing, but also able to turn around and fire and bully people off the ball. It was exactly the type of player that Spain was hoping for when they convinced him to join the team, when he was considering which side to join. And if that's a common occurrence for Spain for the rest of the tournament, if he continues to play at that level, then I think that's a huge addition for Spain moving forward. I mean, you know, but at the same time, I think, you know, you have to feel really good for Portugal, because at the same time as everything was kind of finally being fixed for Spain, Portugal came out and played a really competent team, didn't back down with their block. They took the lead a couple times, and you know, they were playing with really competent defensive organization, and then, you know, relying on their counterattacking trio, really duo of Gonzalo Guedes and Cristiano Ronaldo. And interestingly, for me, I thought the Guedes didn't actually perform the way I expected him to. And if you're Portugal, you can expect him to kind of improve through the tournament. And if that's so, no one thought Portugal would make a deep run in the Euro Cup, except for like you and me and a couple other people who were saying, look, this team, if you can defend competently and then take your chances when you have them, you can make a run in any cup competition. I think Portugal has to be feeling pretty good about their chances moving forward, especially considering they weren't even firing on all cylinders on attack. Like, I think there was this incredible moment when Ronaldo kind of squared this ball to Guedes, who didn't, you know, he had a real attempt to he could have shot, and instead of, you know, just taking it first touch, he decided to take a touch and got the ball stolen. It was you got to feel like Portugal could have executed even better, and they still scored three goals.
Yeah, there was, it must be mentioned that in that span of time when Spain was trying to figure out how to get themselves together after Ronaldo scored the penalty, Guedes blew, like you said, a huge chance on the counterattack. And I just want to quickly mention, Ronaldo was really fucking fast on that play. I posted a GIF earlier on Twitter.
He still has it, baby.
Yeah, he outpaced Guedes, who was going at full tilt. I mean, Guedes is a fast player. He is fast, and Ronaldo outpaced him like it was nothing. And before scoring the ball over to him, I mean, there was that period, that 10-minute period where Spain was trying to figure it out, where Portugal could have killed off the game.
Yeah.
And it was disappointing from my perspective that they didn't. But there's promise they're going forward. And I actually believe this Portugal team is better than the one that played in Euro 2016, because the players they have are more mature.
Yeah.
They're being defending champions gives you a certain amount of experience. I believe Ronaldo has a new level of belief now in this team. And I wouldn't say this makes them favorites for the World Cup or anything, but I would say they're better prepared to make a deep run than they were in Euro 2016.
Yeah.
So I think a semifinals appearance is pretty possible. I think quarterfinals is more likely, but I would not be surprised to see Ronaldo take this team to the semifinals.
I wouldn't be shocked either, especially if everything kind of continues to just get a little bit more tight on defense, and if Guedes kind of grows into the tournament, which one hopes he will, because, you know, having watched him all season at Valencia, we know how dangerous and lethal he can be. I mean, he was absolutely the most dangerous player for Valencia when they played against Real Madrid, and you know, that was against a team that was trying their best to shut him down. That was a club team, right? And so he put on a show. And I think that maybe the stage got to him a little bit, where, you know, he finally realized, like, this is my big moment in front of a global audience to announce myself. And I mean, I think that's totally reasonable. And he has two more games in the group stage. Obviously, Portugal needs to get a result against these two other teams, but, you know, one hopes that that's not going to be super hard for them, and he'll have time to grow into himself as they head forward into the knockout stages.
Yep, I can't disagree with anything you said there.
I will also add that in terms of the Spain, I think, so I talked a little bit on the radio in, you know, today, no, yesterday about that. And I will say that I think that what Spain needs to really work on and think a little bit, you know, think through a little bit is how they want to, and how they want to make their substitutions. So for example, like, I didn't think that Diego Costa was gassed when Iago Aspas came on. And I was a little bit surprised that because he was such a force holding the ball, right? You know, it's those things where Spain has never been a team that really can whack the ball upfield and expect anyone to get on the end of it and really hold it. They didn't ever have that kind of player until Diego Costa, until like maybe Morata sort of has that ability. But taking him off removes the kind of danger when Spain makes a clearance right out of the back. And I thought that was a complicated decision by Hierro. And, you know, on some level, right, this Spain team is a machine that sort of runs on its own, and you just point it in one direction and kind of let it go. The coach's decisions really at this point really only come to who starts and who comes off. And I thought that Hierro sort of made some mistakes on both ends. I'm not sure, for example, that I would have started Nacho on the right wing. Obviously, I love Nacho, but Lopetegui had been kind of telegraphing that his plan was to start Odriozola on that right wing, on that right back position. And I wouldn't have taken off Costa as early. So on the two times that I think really we can question Hierro's decision-making, I think that he may have come off a little lacking, but hopefully he learns a little bit from those decisions. And obviously Nacho actually ended up completing a pretty solid game with that beautiful goal that he scored. But I mean, it was a very silly penalty and a very silly challenge from him on Ronaldo.
Yeah. And I think that's the only thing I'd be concerned about if I was a Spain fan, because essentially what Hierro was doing was he was just implementing Lopetegui's blueprint. He wasn't changing anything that the previous manager did. They basically went in with the same tactics that they've had for the past year or so, and it was Spain that kind of adapted on the fly, and Hierro just let it happen.
Right.
So the only issue would be if Hierro has to make some kind of in-game change, whether that's a substitution or he has to change something up tactically, that's when I'd be concerned, because I really have no idea about Yedo's managing ability, and I don't know if he would be competent in doing that. So you've kind of got to hope that plan A always works for Spain, and that if a little hitch comes, the team can just work it out themselves. Yeah. And I'm fairly confident they can, given the experience and technical quality and tactical intelligence on the field. But there's always a risk it doesn't, because that's the coach's job at the end of the day. Yeah. And if it does, I think that's where Spain could be caught out.
Yeah, I agree. Now, moving on to some of the other games, though, that obviously Spain-Portugal so far is the match of the tournament. I mean, so far, all of the main contenders have wildly disappointed. I mean, we'll have to see how Belgium, England, and some of the other big names play in their first match. But just like moving forward in this tournament, we've seen, Argentina starring Lionel Messi just brutally choke to a very compact, well-defended. Hey, they are. And they, I mean, Iceland benefits from some luck.
Oh,
they
I was laughing at Messi. I wasn't laughing at Iceland.
Okay. They are. Iceland, I mean, a lot of people who didn't watch the Euro Cup just kind of dismissed Iceland. But, I mean, my gut was telling me that they had a 1-1 draw in them against Argentina, or like a scoring draw in them against Argentina. I didn't predict it. I predicted a 1-0 to Argentina. But 1-0 against Iceland would have been a really still a good result for Iceland. And, you know, Iceland really put up a fight, and they really scared that Argentine team. And I think they really got into Messi's head. For whatever reason, you know, I don't know if there's ever been, and maybe the best comparison for Messi is actually, and this is something that I'm going to float for the first time ever on this podcast, maybe the best comparison for Messi, because is someone like Shaq, in that I've never seen someone be this good at this sport in all a lot of like almost every aspect of this sport, but so horribly like below average at
free throws and penalties.
Fucking free throws and penalties. Like, how's that possible? Like,
I think Messi's missed his last 5 out of his last 10 penalties.
What I heard was that it was 4 out of his last 7, but whatever. It's basically the same percentage, and like that is crazy low. It's crazy low.
It just goes to show that, I don't know, maybe having Pinaldo on your team is a good thing. Penalties are hard, especially in pressure situations like that. I mean, we saw Ronaldo take it without hesitation, and he put it away. I think it's gotten kind of in Messi's head. He's missed quite a few high-profile penalties now over the course of his career, kind of starting against Chelsea in the Champions League semifinals. But I don't think we should over-exaggerate it either. Ronaldo also missed a penalty versus Iceland in Euro 2016. I'm not going to stop laughing now. I mean, you don't have that many chances to get your banter in when Messi's an opposing player.
Right.
So, you know, have your fun now. But I would definitely not count him out. There's still 2 more games. They picked up a draw. It's not the end of the world. But things definitely aren't looking the greatest for Argentina. I'm not sure Sampaoli was the best coach for this team, because his style doesn't fit the personnel. I mean, he wants to play an intense, high-pressing game with a bunch of old players in midfield. I'm pretty uncertain about Argentina. I mean, it could go either way. Messi could lift them. You know, Aguero stepped up in a big way in the group stage game with his goal. They still have quality individuals on offense who can carry them, but as a system, they're extremely poor. And you know, that doesn't necessarily bode well for them.
No. In terms of other kind of higher profile Real Madrid players, we saw obviously Ashraf playing for Morocco in their really gut-wrenching loss to Iran. I don't have anything to say about that game other than he was in it. And Iran won the game on a Morocco own goal in minute 93, which is one of the most upsetting sentences that I think you can say as a fan, as an analyst.
Like, absolutely brutal.
Oh, in terms of other Madrid players, let's just jump ahead to, you know, just some of the big boys. We've got Rafa Varane playing for France, a France side that benefited from the first ever VAR use in a World Cup that gave them a penalty, and it was in fact a penalty. Griezmann slotted at home. France beat Australia 2-1 with a Paul Pogba winner in the last little bit of time. Varane obviously is still fantastic. And I think that, the next big game for in terms of Real Madrid, we're all today, which is basically Keylor Navas in the morning. Costa Rica really had – like, I feel like Costa Rica was the better side playing against Serbia, but Serbia had a very brilliant free kick strike that Keylor could do nothing about, and they lost 1-0. Just couldn't break down that Serbian defense. And then we had, I think – one of the upsets, probably the upset of the tournament so far, which was Mexico 1, Germany 0. We had former Madrid players, Khedira and Ozil. And then, I mean, let's talk a little bit about Toni. Toni Kroos playing an instrumental role for his German side. But I think, you know, as we were talking before we started recording, I'm not sure he was particularly used well.
Yeah, so this was a very much a case of Germany having an obvious tactical flaw that Mexico took, I don't want to say good advantage of, because they did blow a ton of counterattacking opportunities, but at the end of the day, they did take advantage of it. And it was essentially this. Germany went in with a Khedira, Kroos midfield, double pivot, and Ozil ahead of them. And they had patient, very structured possession play, mainly in the right side of the field, and they tried to break down Mexico that way. And Mexico were very aggressive in their pressing on all areas of the field, not allowing Germany to ever be comfortable. And so obviously that led to losses of possession. And so In what's basically been a pattern for many years now, Germany tried to counterpress and win the ball back instantly, and they were actually well set up to do it. It's just that Kroos, Khedira, that midfield was just far too slow. So Mexico were beating those players one-on-one, running in behind them, and Kroos was left in the dust 4 or 5 times, and they were running straight at the German defense. And it's not like Germany have very fast center backs in Hummels and Boateng either. And so Mexico had tons and tons of counterattacking opportunities, and the German coach never really responded to it. I mean, the only substitution he made that affected that midfield was taking off Khedira for Royce, which left Kroos as the only central midfielder in the squad. And at the end of the day, they came away with a 1-0 loss. So I think Kroos actually played a pretty decent role in possession. I think Mexico did a pretty good job of shutting him down, and that Kroos wasn't able to be, you know, as influential in the way you expect him. I mean, he was still pretty good. He was involved, but he wasn't necessarily making the most decisive plays in the way that you'd expect. And then he was burned on the counter time and time again. And I think this is a weakness Germany has in personnel. I'm not sure that many midfielders they have that can solve that problem. I mean, Gundogan isn't that mobile.
Right.
I mean, people were talking about Goretzka. I guess he is more mobile. His offensive, is he as good offensively? I mean, Khedira is really the only box-to-box player they have. And
Khedira is still, like, he's definitely has lost not just one, but like 5 or 6 steps since he was a key
player.
Yeah,
after multiple injuries.
Right.
So I think the only way to solve this, in my opinion, is structurally. So move away from the double pivot and have a 3-man midfield. Yep. So you have 2 central midfielders guarding the half space and a defensive midfielder when they get behind.
Yep.
But, you know, let's see what he does, because this is a big problem and Mexico have exposed it in the first game. So I'd be surprised if other teams didn't attempt to do the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see, because, like, fundamentally what we have in the Germany-Mexico group, it is one of the weaker groups outside of them. South Korea, not a great squad, but they do have some pace in Sun, a couple other players, and then Sweden, who are more of a kind of built the kind of team identity of being more of a compact side. Like, they don't have Zlatan anymore, but they've built their team being more sort of in this almost a Portugal-like medium to low block and then trying to run on counters. And we'll see if that works against Germany. I still have Germany and Mexico coming through, though. I do think it's very possible that Germany comes out second out of this group, which would possibly mean after the other result, but it's possible that they will have a Germany-Brazil matchup in the round of 16.
That would be interesting. I mean, I could be wrong here, but I think there was a statistic that said from 1998 or something, the World Cup, the defending champion hasn't come out of the group stage if that defending champion was from Europe. I mean, I don't think Germany's going out in the group stage, but that would be That would be epic.
That would
epic
it would be one.
I
of
mean,
the
I guess
great
if you're
upsets.
if you're a German fan, that would suck. But if you're a neutral, that would be kind of like seeing Brazil lose 7-1, and it's just it's just one of those things you got to see.
Well, I'll say that last World Cup, obviously Spain didn't come out, but Spain was in a very, very good group with Holland and Chile. So in my view, the way my brain rationalized it was, look, this was a World Cup hangover. They didn't come out and they didn't train in the kind of overwhelming heat and humidity. Spanish players can deal with heat, but humidity kind of floors them. And then they just got outplayed by Chile and by Holland. They were already eliminated by the third game. So, I mean, we'll see. I mean, Germany literally now has to get results, like basically has to win against both Korea and Sweden. But is that really such a big ask for them? I don't think so. So, especially if, for example, I think it's the first game of the day, Sweden, Korea is a draw. If there's a draw, then Germany will feel much better about their chances of coming out. If not, then they might be in a little bit more of trouble. So, moving on to another huge match was Brazil-Switzerland. So Brazil came out of the gates incredibly strong against Switzerland. Probably one of the best first 20 minutes I've seen from a Brazil side in almost a decade.
Yeah, so they looked motivated. They looked like they wanted to be out there. I mean, because essentially with this Brazil team, if you didn't watch the game, it was – when Neymar was out, we were used to seeing a Paulinho, Fernandinho, Casemiro midfield. And with Neymar back, they put Coutinho back on the left side of that midfield in a three-man midfield. And then you had Neymar and Marcelo on the left. So Brazil were exploiting the hell out of that. I mean,
Spain really good.
Kind of had that pattern, but it looked good. The first 20 minutes, Brazil had really good passing combinations. I mean, it must be said that Neymar didn't look fully fit, but in the first 20 minutes, he looked involved.
Okay, but I'll also say really quickly with Neymar that Switzerland had a very clear, very obvious strategy in this match, which was we're going to come in and we're going to hammer Neymar. And it's not going to be a little bit. It's not going to be random. It's going to be every single time he touches the ball. If you were like one of the things that I was looking for was how Neymar was going to deal with being hit, because I knew he was going to be hit when he came out. But because I was tracking that, I was watching very clearly, and it was 90%+ of the time he had the ball, he would end up on the ground. And it wasn't just in like 50-50 tackles or whatever. There were occasions where someone would grab his neck and just yank him down. I mean, it was I was very disgusted by the kind of cynical way that Switzerland decided to play Neymar. And, you know, whatever. I need to get over it a little bit, I understand. But I was really hoping to see a little bit more of that Jogo Bonito stuff from the Brazilians. And I think the Swiss did have a game plan. They executed it really well. And it was to play a really compact Swiss style, like their classic defense, and hit Neymar as hard as they could whenever he had the ball.
Yes. So Neymar suffered the most fouls of any player, I think, since like 1966 or something. He suffered 10 fouls in the game, which is kind of ridiculous. And I think the last player to suffer more suffered 11. So you are absolutely right on that. That's not just something you're imagining in your head. And so I think that definitely played a role, because Brazil definitely, especially after the Coutinho goal went in, which is, by the way, a beautiful strike, from outside the box, classic Coutinho strike. I think because Brazil rely on Neymar so much when they play through the left, I think Neymar was feeling the challenges. Plus, he wasn't fully fit, and you could really see that he wasn't himself after that. And Brazil's attacks just started to kind of break down, and they didn't really have an answer for that. They didn't have a plan B. They couldn't really move to the right because Paulinho didn't really offer passing connections in his place on the right side of midfield. So it was a very one-dimensional attack when they went to the right side, and Switzerland kind of figured it out, and then they eventually scored from a set piece, and it was deadlocked from there.
Yeah, and you get the sense. Look. You got the sense that there wasn't any more in it after Switzerland scored, despite the fact that Brazil just was throwing what they had. And it was because they lacked a level of creativity in some of their passing combinations. One of the things that was really galling to me was in Real Madrid and the way Madrid plays, there's a huge amount of changing the point of attack by long balls across the field. And one of the things that Brazil just simply didn't do, like the only player that was making those big passes was Marcelo. And I can't tell why Brazil decided that they wanted to try to move it player by player, but it would just always feel like whenever they tried to switch the point of attack, it would be three passes and then Marcelo would have the ball. But then at that point, Switzerland had managed to reform their defense. And I just felt like one of the things that Brazil really needed to do against a defense that stuck in was to continuously shift the point of attack the way that Real Madrid does. And maybe this just speaks to the tactical deficiencies of international football, but it just seems so obvious to me that Switzerland had a very clear game plan and a very clear structure. They were very good at moving around, but there is one way to attack a structure like that, as Madrid has shown, as other teams that play a lot of players, you know, in these that get bunkered in like Switzerland does, and it's to move the ball from side to side very quickly and then to make cutting runs on the wings in order to shuttle the ball back inside. And I really didn't see Brazil doing much of that.
Yeah, I think you make a really, really great point there. I mean, I think Tite didn't come into this game just planning for that, because he's relied on kind of those left-sided combinations for so long. And so I think so far in the World Cup, I mean, we've only been one match day in. But I think so far we've seen some really big victory for tactics here, which isn't a common thing to see on the international stage. And I personally enjoy it. I mean, everyone knows I'm a tactics guy, but it just goes to show that teams like Mexico and teams like Switzerland, when you're facing overwhelming favorites to go on and win the entire thing, a very cogent, you know, rigorous tactical plan that looks to exploit the very obvious weaknesses of your opponent can go a long way to giving you a result. And I think that should give hope to smaller teams, because this is international football. There will be deficiencies that cannot be solved because you cannot go out and buy players. So that gives more agency to the coach in a way, even though the coaches don't have enough time to plan, the squad doesn't have enough cohesion. In some ways, they have a little more agency than they do in club football. And I'm talking about the coaches of smaller teams to build a plan to attack the weaknesses of bigger teams.
Yeah.
And we haven't necessarily seen that so much in a consistent manner in previous World Cups. And I think that makes the World Cup a lot more exciting. We get more potential for upsets. And I hope this theme continues.
I agree. I totally agree. And I'm hopeful that federations are taking note of that, not just thinking that these are flukes, that these are actually, you know, carefully constructed game plans that work. And when they're executed properly, they work against even the best teams in the entire world, the best international teams, at least. And it was very close to Australia pulling off a huge upset, maybe bigger than any of the other ones, and drawing France. But, you know, Paul Pogba simply, there was just that little bit of quality at the very end of that match that allowed for it. But man, oh man, I totally agree. It's been a huge victory for tactics. One last match that I wanted to bring up before we move on to our second subject. I want to talk about Croatia, not necessarily Croatia versus Nigeria, but I do think that Croatia versus Nigeria, the tactics are very interesting in that game. But specifically, actually, let's just do the tactics first. One of the things I noticed a lot in Croatia-Nigeria was that the kind of very unknowledgeable soccer the commentary team of the Fox soccer, they didn't understand why. They kept saying, I don't understand why Nigeria is not using that. I mean, all the classic stuff that people always say about African teams. Why aren't they using their pace and physicality more? Well, there are two things. First of all, the Nigerian Federation's tactics were genuinely stymied by the Croatian tactics. Like the way that the Croatian team deployed Modric, Rakitic, and some of their other center midfielders was entirely to prevent that type of long ball counterattack, assuming that that's even how Nigeria plays, which is kind of complicated. And Nigeria's tactics, and again, I'm saying tactics because this was a choice Nigeria made, was basically to move the ball through Victor Moses on the right. And Victor Moses isn't actually that good a player. I mean, they have a lot of other strong players on that squad that could have, and they could have used a lot more diversity in their tactics. But essentially, all they did was assume Croatia wouldn't be able to handle Victor Moses's dribbling and running up the right flank. And Croatia basically designed an entire formation that allowed for them to compensate for any overloading on that side. I thought Croatia did really well to kind of neutralize that particular thing. And then Nigeria didn't know how to respond to it.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. I would say going forward, though, I would like to see a change in Modric's role because this has not just been in this match. This is a thing which has been with Croatia for years, is they have so much midfield talent. They have Rakitic, they have Modric, they have Kovacic.
Who didn't start.
Yeah, the managers just haven't been able to make it all work, and Kovacic usually sits on the bench because they can't really see him starting. I mean, it's too late to change to something like a diamond midfield, but what I would like to see is Modric play higher. Yeah. Because essentially he's been playing as a defensive midfielder for an extremely long time in this Croatian team, and while he's extremely good at that role, it's a bit of a waste. It's a shame, really, because where he's best is influencing the final third. And I really think Modric can make more of an impact if he's allowed a bit more freedom like he is at Real Madrid to influence proceedings.
Yeah. And you know,
otherwise, he's mainly acting as a distributor and he's doing a ton of defensive work.
I mean, one way to do that would be to actually bring in Kovacic to the position that they currently have Modric starting and just move Modric up the pitch, literally play a three-man midfield of Kovacic behind Modric and Rakitic, right? Like it actually to me is some version of that could very well be a way that Madrid can structure their midfield in the future going forward. And we've talked about this before, that Kovacic, I think, is a very interesting option as a kind of interchanging defensive midfielder for Real Madrid. And if you, for example, want to rotate Casemiro out, and we've seen Kovacic perform admirably in that position. I will also add that, again, shout out Fox Sports for calling Kovacic a quote defender.
Oh my God, man.
I mean,
Fox has just been horrible. I mean, there was an article that came out a couple of days before the World Cup that just absolutely trashed Fox Sports. And if you haven't read it, you should, because it was the most brutal article I've ever read. I mean, it was an all-out attack on Fox and Alexi Lalas, and I loved it so much because it was so accurate. And, I mean, they've been proven completely right. I mean, Stuart Holden is really the only guy I really like on Fox because he offers some insight. But otherwise, everyone else has just been really, really bad. Right. With their insight and all of that, and just
I'm extremely defending Perez Navarro and Trujillo, who were the commentators for the Peru match. That was by far and away the best commentator so far. And the only reason that one of the reasons is that they really cared. They showed their passion. They were obvious. Like, one of the things that really gets me is that those guys were so clearly well prepared. They knew exactly how, not only what players were playing, but also how to pronounce each player's name perfectly. So the Fox commentary team was saying during the Germany, and this was finally got me to actually watch the games on Telemundo, was they started calling Mesut Ozil Ozil, and among other many, but like, how do you not know it? And then Kroos, and like, I get Kroos, but Ozil, like, I just couldn't figure it out. So I switched to Telemundo, and you know what the most damning part of it all was? Is that Telemundo was doing essentially perfect pronunciations of the German name. They were like, Jona Huerkon Mesut Ozil. And I was like, what? How do you know how to pronounce that and the English people don't? It's ridiculous. So that's basically all I have on the World Cup matches so far. I'm very disappointed that Peru couldn't grab one back. Peru is my second team this World Cup. I love them. As soon as Spain and Portugal are out of their group, I'll be rooting for Portugal. I always root for the Iberians. That's sort of just another part of my blood. But also, like, Peru is so much fun, guys. I really love them. And it bummed me out that they couldn't get a result in that first game, because that was the one that they needed to win or get at least get a draw on if they were going to have any hope of moving forward.
And they missed a penalty.
They missed a penalty. It's one of those things. You can always tell when someone is about to miss a penalty if they take a huge run-up. Like, they sprint at the ball.
The dude did the Zaza run-up. If you're going to do that run-up, you're going to miss.
Yeah.
I mean, people should have learned by now.
Yeah. And you know who – I mean, Modric's penalty was absolute perfection for me. That was the best penalty kick of the – I mean, Cristiano's was fantastic. He hit it. But one of the things that Cristiano does is that he doesn't always place it perfectly, but he has enough power in his leg and enough confidence in himself that he can smash it, but he's smashing it with basically perfect precision. So it doesn't need to go perfectly next to the post. Modric – what he did was he decided not to smash it, but hit it hard enough and within 6 inches of that post, and no keeper in the world is making that save. It's just not. So it kind of broke my heart looking at the Modric penalty and being like, man, you only need two steps if you're going to hit a penalty. You really don't need a long run up. So that's sort of that. All right, do you want to go on? So let's talk a little bit, Om, now about why we're conflicted. And it's not just that FIFA itself is a comically corrupt organization that has blood on its hands. It's also that there have been, I mean, the simple decision to host the World Cup in Russia has brought up a lot of, you know, political problems and problems of morality. So, for example, Russia is a country that's famously bad for gay people and minorities.
Mm-hmm. So this is an issue because it's not something we can dodge, right? Because there's people that are like, you know, keep politics out of sports or whatever. I mean, this is part of sports. This is the World Cup. These are fans being affected. So, for example, a gay French couple, were brutally attacked at the World Cup. A couple hours or so before the opening game between Russia and Saudi Arabia, and they were sent to the hospital. It was so bad, and they were attacked in St. Petersburg, and People warned FIFA years before they decided to select Russia that this is dangerous, because there were groups openly talking about how they were going to hunt down gay couples, gay people who came to the World Cup, because they essentially see them as subhuman. This is the issue, right? Because if this game is supposed to be for everyone, right? Literally everyone. It's a global game. It's the World Cup. Absolutely everyone should be able to enjoy it in the same manner. How is that possible when you hold it in a place like this, which very clearly sees a large portion of the world's population as subhuman and undeserving of enjoying the pleasures of football like the rest of us.
Right. And
so in addition, that is a huge problem.
And in addition, they're a regime that openly supports the a Chechen warlord who's throwing gay people in concentration camps. And you can look that up. That's also a real thing that's going on. And, we also had an incident a couple of days ago where a man in I can't remember which city it was, but took his car and drove it into a group of people who were Mexicans. And it's not clear if it was exactly what was going on, but it does seem pretty likely that there was a hate motivated aspect to that. You don't just smash a car into people for no reason.
Yeah, and also there was a UK gay rights activist who was arrested in Moscow, and he was protesting the acts in Chechnya, like you mentioned before. So I mean, it's just a question of, is this game for everyone? Because basically, essentially, what the bladder era supposedly started, I mean, this was the propaganda he was spreading, was, I'm spreading this game all over the world to countries. I'm placing the World Cup in countries like South Africa, you know, because this is a world game. It shouldn't just be held in the traditional powerhouse countries. This game is for everyone. Well, if this game is really for everyone, then should we host it in a place like Russia, which has made very overt statements about how this game is not for everyone, how everyone is not welcome.
Right.
And in a very violent way as well, as I just mentioned before. And next we have a World Cup in Qatar, where it's illegal to be gay, where there were horrible human rights abuses to build the stadiums. And I mean, this is kind of a question we have every World Cup. I mean, what we're talking about right now is very specific to this instance, but there were issues with hosting the World Cup in Brazil. And it's something you cannot ignore, because every World Cup it comes up, and it's something we need to address head on. I personally do not believe, you know, the journalism world at large has done the greatest job of covering this so far. I mean, because it's sort of understandable, right? I mean, this is about having fun, right? And people don't want it to be ruined, but this is just a reality because it is being ruined for so many fans across the world, and it's something we have to address head on. I wish more prominent journalists than us would step up about it more. And it took a couple tweets that I saw today kind of detailing all these things to wake me up and say, hey, I'd kind of been ignoring that too when I talked about it before the World Cup. And it's just sad. And it's something FIFA could have addressed. Yeah. FIFA was warned. They weren't blind about this. And this is where we are.
No, and instead of addressing it, and there are – and to the people who say, well, what is FIFA supposed to do? Actually, there are tons of things FIFA can do. It's not that complicated. For example, FIFA literally in 2010, FIFA – and then it eventually did. FIFA threatened to sanction the Nigerian Football Federation because they were withholding bonus payments to their players after they did such a quote-unquote bad job in the World Cup. Well – I mean, that was the same World Cup in 2010 where the North Korean, North Korea had such a bad showing that Kim Jong-il at that point sent the coach to a goddamn work camp, and FIFA had nothing to say about that. I mean, FIFA are basically very happy to involve themselves in a country's politics when it is convenient and when they feel like they can get away with it. But when it's a country where, like, if you looked at the first game of the World Cup was between two really, I mean, really... really bad regimes, folks. It was between Russia and Saudi Arabia. And there was this cut to a number of times Vladimir Putin sitting with Gianni Infantino and Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. So this is not, like, simply not a... And I mean, it's an avenue where we do, and it's we should be constantly talking about it and criticizing FIFA and understand ourselves that this isn't just some sort of thing that we can push to the side, but we should be morally and ethically conflicted about this. Look, there's this great segment on John Oliver, his show, where I'm just going to quickly, cut in some of the audio.
I would like to talk to you about the sausage principle, the theory that says if you love something, never find out how it was made. Well, tonight, I would like to show you my sausage. Wait. This is my sausage.
The 2014 FIFA World Cup.
Oh, my God! Okay, the World Cup starts this week, and I am both excited and extremely conflicted about it. Now, I know, in America, soccer is something you pick your 10-year-old daughter up from. But for me and everyone else on Earth, it's a little more important.
Soccer had become Brazil's religion.
In Colombia, soccer was a religion.
Football is a religion here.
Soccer, or football, like we say, it's a religion.
Yeah, and they're not exaggerating. When David Beckham got a tattoo of Jesus, the response of most soccer fans was, "Oh, that's huge for Jesus. That's a big deal for him." Here's my conflict. The World Cup is one of my favorite things, but it's organized by these guys, FIFA. You either know it as the Fédération Internationale de Football Association, or that soccer video game you have. But for American viewers who may never have encountered them, FIFA is a comically grotesque organization. In fact, telling someone about the inner workings of FIFA for the first time is a bit like showing someone two girls, one cup. You do it mainly so you can watch the horrified expression on people's faces. Because let's start where FIFA's current World Cup is about to take place, Brazil. Brazilians are excited about everything. This is how they celebrate the fact that it's just about to be Lent. They love the concept of giving up chocolate temporarily. They're also the biggest soccer fans on Earth, so they must be thrilled at the prospect of hosting the World Cup.
There's been months of unrest in some of the city's favelas, or slums, with clashes between police and residents. Here, people demonstrated against Brazil holding the World Cup.
That makes no sense. Why would you be unhappy hosting the thing that you love the most in all the world?
The government has spent more than $11 billion getting ready.
The United States team will play its second game here in the city of Manaus, in this brand new $270 million stadium.
Manaus is so remote,
that it's almost impossible to reach by car, which is why officials had to have the stadium materials brought in by boat, shipped across the Atlantic from Portugal and up the Amazon River.
Okay, that does seem like a waste of money, especially when you consider that that stadium is only going to be used for 4 World Cup games. There's also no team in Manaus that can fill it afterwards, at which point it becomes the world's most expensive bird toilet. No wonder Brazilians are so upset, especially when you think about what they are actually getting in return.
Well, and they're going to make money as well as the money they're spending.
Actually, FIFA makes the money. This is where the controversy is. The country usually doesn't make money. FIFA, the organization of the World Cup, is who makes the money.
Yeah, Brazil, let me put this in terms you might understand. Think of money as pubic hair and FIFA as wax. Oh, they're going to be all over you during the World Cup, but when they go, they're taking all the money with them. Including some from places you didn't even know you had any money. Leaving you teary-eyed going, Jesus, what happened here? What happened? I'm never doing this again. Because here are FIFA's tax demands for prospective host countries.
It is FIFA and its FIFA subsidiaries that are fully exempt from any tax whatsoever levied at whatever level, state level, municipality level, all sorts of taxes, consumption taxes, income taxes, you name it, it's all exempt.
That's right. By Brazil's own estimates, they're allowing FIFA to forego $250 million in taxes. Somewhere, Wesley Snipes is going, so soccer was the answer. Oh, God. It seems so obvious now. Now, FIFA says they leave a lot behind, which they do, like new laws. Because, you see, once upon a time, Brazil did this.
In 2003, the Brazilian government banned alcohol from stadiums because of the enormously high death rate amongst fans.
Well, that seems like a good idea. Potentially life-saving, even. The only problem is, Budweiser is one of FIFA's key sponsors, and they sell a product they reflexively insist on calling beer. And FIFA seemed anxious to protect Budweiser from a law designed to protect people, which is why FIFA's Secretary General went to Brazil with a simple message.
I'm sorry to say, and maybe I look a bit arrogant, but that's something we'll not negotiate. I mean, there will be, and there must be, as part of the law, the fact that we have the right to sell beer.
Right, so as you could hear there, John Oliver talks, right? He says that joke about how if you love, you know, sausage, you should never see how it's made. Well, this is exactly that, right? This is, as he says, his sausage. And this is my sausage. This is our sausage. And it's almost reprehensible and kind of dumb of us not to just get involved and think about exactly how the sausage is made with respect to this competition that we all love.
And also, there's nothing obviously that can be done now about the World Cup being hosted in Russia. But, you know, I forgot to mention that there were homophobic chants within particular fan bases,
right,
that came to stadiums, prepared homophobic chants, and they shouted them. There are very harsh fines that can be doled out for that. You can hold federations responsible.
Yeah, it's not complicated.
And when you do when federations do get fined a severe amount, like we've seen – you know, ridiculous amounts of fines for really stupid shit. And then you can compare it to some of the fines handed out for racism. And it's just almost comical how FIFA doesn't seem to care about any of this stuff. I mean, they're literally not doing anything in regard to this. And I think that's just what annoys me the most. I mean, there are concrete measures, like you said, that can be taken, and they just couldn't care less.
Yeah,
so, I mean, this isn't new. Obviously, FIFA doesn't give a shit about making the game open for everyone, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't give about it. You know,
right.
FIFA have openly said this is their standard, this is what we want to do, and, you know, we should do our best to hold them to it. And really, that's more on us. That's more on journalists, which is why I said I think journalism needs to do a bit better job on this. But, you know, I think we're taking a step here, at least, you know, by informing our base about this, and hopefully it'll spark discussion. We can move to some degree of holding FIFA accountable for this, because if we don't do this as a collective, we're just going to keep seeing this over and over again.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, I think that rounds out that section. We're going to quickly take your questions, and then again, remember, I'm going to be splicing in about 5 minutes of my own chat some journalists on the radio about Spain and about Real Madrid's future. So Blake Brown asks us, wow, what a first game for Spain. Was this a preview of what we could see from Isco being the featured player next year for Madrid? So I think this gets it to a lot of people have been, you know, kind of saying this basic formulation of this question, which is this: Lopetegui has gotten some really all-timer performances out of Isco. So people are kind of saying, look, is Isco bringing Lopetegui in going to make Isco kind of finally take that next step into the consistent superstar role that I personally think he's one tiny step short of?
So I don't want to say no, because I think the truth is that no one can say definitively, simply because international football is so incredibly different from club football.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Lopetegui's relationship with Isco definitely helps. They obviously like each other, and I think Lopetegui will make an effort to make Isco one of his main guys in the team. But it's so different. Like, the tactics are so different in international football. A lot of times there are no tactics. You know, there's a certain level of fluidity that allows a team like Spain to thrive with all their technically gifted players that would allow Isco to take advantage of that situation. I mean, there's no guarantee that this transfer is over. I mean, we kind of saw it with Van Gaal and Robin Van Persie and Memphis Depay. There have been other cases as well where there were really great relationships and performances, and the coach knew how to get the best out of a player on the international stage, and then it didn't transfer to a totally different context in club football, where the tactical structures are far more rigorous, teams are better prepared, the way you have to play changes a little bit. So, you know, like I said, again, I don't want to say no, because the truth is I really don't know, but I would pump the brakes on that excitement just a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a lot of uncertainty there.
I totally agree. And I will also add that if you go back and listen to Keon's really fantastic chat with one of my favorite authors, Phil Ball, Phil says a bunch of stuff basically along this vein, that Lopetegui is ultimately a professional and a good coach and a good man manager. And so what he's going to do is he's going to make the best out of what he has. He's not going to favor Isco. He's not going to favor the Spanish players. Mm-hmm. He's going to make a team that he thinks is going to produce the best results. And that could involve playing Isco in kind of this featured role. But he's not going to, like, give up on Bale or Ronaldo or something just because he wants to feature Isco more. That's just simply not the way this is going to go. And if you're mm-hmm. looking for that to happen, then you're going to be disappointed.
That's a very good point.
So I think it's important to remember that he does come into the job with the support of a number of the players, which is a really good thing. But that doesn't mean that he is going to just kind of reproduce the Spanish lineups or whatever just to get Isco involved. I'm cautiously optimistic about everything. I think that before we see anything happen, we should be cautiously optimistic. I don't have any reason to necessarily think that he's going to be a bad coach or whatever. Anthony Lombardi asks us, wow, what a cup so far for Real Madrid players. Ronaldo is leading in goals, and I haven't watched one Madrid player play badly so far. Let's say Ronaldo scores the most goals and is the best player. What would Florentino do? Buy the second best player? yes. I mean, I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but again, I've been saying all year that Madrid is going to make some transfer decisions based on the World Cup, and that hasn't always been the best strategy, but it uh-huh. did work well with Toni Kroos, for example, who they bought after a very good World Cup. Anthony continues, if you don't think Ronaldo will end up with the most goals / being the best player, then who do you guys think will end up being the best player of the tournament / most goals?
That's a very difficult question.
That is a crazy difficult question after we haven't even seen all the first round games.
I'm still gonna go with Neymar. I mean, he didn't have the greatest game, but Neymar is unreal on the international stage. I mean, I would very strongly say, this could be my hot take for the podcast, that on the international stage, there is no player better than Neymar. Not Ronaldo, not Messi, no one. I mean, you look at his record with Brazil and his goal per game ratio, I mean, it's insane. He blows everyone out of the water. He has consistently performed in all tournaments for Brazil. I mean, it was really disappointing to see him not perform this time, because it's so rare to not see him perform. So
Switzerland literally tried to mark him out of the game. So
yeah, so if So if the ref doesn't let other teams attempt to kill Neymar and Neymar gets a little bit of his fitness back, I mean, the dude is a boss. I mean, he just really understands how to play with everyone with the personnel that he has on the field, and he knows how to raise his game because he knows the expectation that is placed on him. He knows everyone sees him as the next Ronaldo, the next Ronaldinho, the next Pele, and he rises to that. So if it's not Ronaldo, I think Neymar is a fairly safe bet.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's a safe bet. I think a more out there bet, and we haven't seen him play yet, but I think that everything that people have said so far about his training suggests that Eden Hazard, this might be his tournament. If he really puts
Salah,
yeah. No, it doesn't seem likely that he's even going to come out of the group, so... I think that if you were a betting man, you'd get some odds. It might be Hazard just because this Belgium team actually is not getting enough buzz. They are really stacked, and Hazard, by all accounts, is playing out of his mind, and he really could come in and be the man of this tournament. And if he is, I mean, Madrid has been flirting with him forever. It could be the summer that they finally go get him. But I think that may be my choice. And I think there's another option, which we're kind of underselling, which is Harry Kane, who is the best striker that England has produced since Wayne. Or no, sorry, not Wayne Rooney. He's better than Wayne Rooney. He's the best striker England has produced. That's not maybe a hot take, but I think I'm very confident. He's the best striker England's produced since Michael Owen. And
I don't know about that. Wayne Rooney was pretty damn good, but I'd have to think about that one.
So if he catches fire, that could also be huge for them. I wouldn't be shocked if we saw England in the semifinals either. It just needs all of their pieces need to work together. So let's see. Sajid Riaz asks us, Isco to be third best player in the world under Lopetegui. The question is, do you think that Lopetegui can propel Isco into becoming the third best player in the world after Ronaldo and Messi? I mean, he could, right?
Pretty much the response we gave earlier pretty much applies here. I mean, it's so hard to say. I mean, even if Isco really finds his feet under Lopetegui at Real, I wouldn't say he becomes the third best player in the world. I mean, I certainly hope that would happen, but I don't know if that's a ceiling. I think top 10 is like... that's fantastic. I mean, I think that's where Isco's ceiling is. But, you know, if he becomes third best player in the world, that would be incredible.
I mean, top five for me. Like, I could see him, like, sneaking up into that top five conversation. But I don't think there's a lot of people.
Tough because even with Salah's season, I think just based on pure ability, I think Neymar is comfortably the third best player in the world. If he wasn't injured, for me, he would be up there. And I don't think... with CR7 and Messi continually declining with age, I don't think anyone's replacing Neymar.
Yeah. What is the biggest issue we need to rectify to avoid another La Liga disappointment? He says you need to find creative ways to penetrate teams who play like Iceland. I think the number one issue that we need to fix. Is not a personnel one, and I think it's more of a motivational one. One of the things that we saw in the double season was that Zidane managed to motivate the players so that they would come out and never leave any game for dead. And, you know, we saw how many points did Madrid rescue by goals in minute 85 plus, right?
Yeah, it was ridiculous. I think you cannot ignore the mental aspect of our early collapse. And the 17-18 season, I think tactically is where we can really improve the most. I mean, I think we need to be careful about the transfers we make. I mean, I think transfers would be extremely important because we're transitioning away from an older core. But I think tactically, we need to move back to a slightly more structured system that looks so... So I think Sajid is right when he talks about we need to find more creative ways to penetrate teams. I don't think that's the number one issue, but that would be fixed with better offense structure, with better occupation of the spaces in between the lines, with not having Casemiro play as a number 10 for us. But I think most of all, we need to move back to some kind of structure, an overarching philosophy that obviously... will be flexible, but something that helps create this kind of continuity a little bit, because we need to stop being so bad against counterattacks. I mean, we were always kind of weak against it, but last season kind of took it to a new extreme, and it had a lot to do with the fact that we were lacking structure and possession. When we lost the ball, we were not adequately prepared to counter press or move back into shape to recover the ball, and that killed us in a ton of games. So yeah. I think that would be the most important thing to avoid a collapse in La Liga, because La Liga is about consistency, and that starts kind of with the tactical structure that you have. But yeah, I mean, I'd agree. I think Isco can play a big role. I see no reason not to give Isco a bigger role, considering the older core is kind of, if not phased out, they're obviously declining a little bit.
They need to be rotated if you want them, like, the core to be fresh for a run in the spring. And let's also remember that the spring is also when La Liga's won and lost. So, like, as long as Madrid can keep it, you know, reasonable up until then, if they're ready to peak at that exact moment, then they can make a run. They've closed gaps against Barcelona over the last few years in that period of time. And so if they can continue to have that fitness, then I feel pretty good about it. Okay, last two questions are both from a guy called Chris G, my man. So first, they're both transfer-related, so we can answer them pretty quickly. Would you take Alisson over Navas if these rumors are true about the $70 million bid?
I would. I think Alisson is a fantastic player. I mean, I think as a shot stopper, I am not completely sure of whether I could name him as a very elite shot stopper. I think he's quite good. But I think what he really gives you is brilliance on the ball, which is becoming more and more important in the game. I mean, I think he's a very good shot stopper, but what he can take the ball and split defenses with his passes in a way similar to Ederson. I mean, he's not as good, but that's kind of the mold of goalkeeper that he is, and that is very valuable. I think it's something that Navas is kind of weak in, and it's something that's needed, especially if we're assuming Lopetegui wants to come in and play his very kind of dogmatic short passing style out from the back, which he even maintained with his short club stints. Then a goalkeeper like him would definitely help.
I agree.
I'm open to being convinced otherwise. I still need to do more research on him. So, you know, you do your own research as well before just taking my opinions at face value.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't know who is going to be in goal for Real Madrid next season. That is one of the biggest questions on the team sheet, just because it seems clear to me that Florentino is looking to make a change. If it were me, I would really hope that he doesn't just jettison Kaylor. Kaylor is a consummate team player. I think he'd be willing to come in and be the kind of Copa del Rey keeper, if you know, the kind of veteran presence who's working with a younger player. If Florentino goes out and gets someone like De Gea, which, again, it seems possible. There's been this long-term flirtation. Lopetegui and De Gea have a very good relationship dating back to the U19s and U21s. I mean, that wouldn't shock me. Alisson would be a great choice, I think, also. And I'd also be interested in seeing if he goes out. And very possible, again, Lopetegui coached Kepa at those ages. So it's possible he goes out and gets Kepa, despite the kind of, you know, infuriating nature of going out and getting Kepa would mean, right? If you think about it, like, it would mean that they spent
because we could have gotten him in the winter
for essentially pennies on the dollar. So, but yeah, I think any of those are possibilities. And there's also a possibility that somehow another keeper comes into the mix that I hadn't previously even thought about. So those are all options at the keeper position. I can't tell you which is going to happen. I think personally, it's not my money. So again, and Madrid are swimming in it right now without having made big acquisitions. So if they decide they want to drop the, you know, 80 million, 90 million to get De Gea, then maybe they go do that. But I'd be okay. I mean, obviously I'd be okay with that, because he, despite like one or two, and by the way, to the people who are like tweeting at me about like, how can you think De Gea is the best in the world after his mistake? It's like, you know that Messi misses, like, you know, anyone, fucking Babe Ruth got, you know, struck out occasionally. Like, it happens. Like, people make mistakes, and like that has nothing. It's a one-time occurrence. Like, if you have to look at the kind of overall body of work, and the overall body of work from De Gea shows that he is the best in the world, at least last season with Neuer out. Neuer, I think, put in a pretty strong effort against Mexico today, so he looks to be back. Next question from Chris. What do you guys think of the Rodrigo signing? I don't like that we label these players the new Neymar, Cristiano, or Messi. I feel like that's a lot of unnecessary pressure. So just to get everyone up to date, Real Madrid went out and got Brazilian wonderkind Rodrigo from, I think, Santos for $40 million. Very similar to the Vinicius signing. Rodrigo has a huge amount of upside, a lot of projection. People really love him. He's been playing first division football in Brazil already. He's 17, so he won't make it to Madrid until next season. So here's what I think of him, and just tell me if you disagree. My feeling is the way to beat this kind of ridiculous and insane inflated market is to try to figure out how to get assets that have how to get players that are going to improve and develop into potential 100, 150 million euro players, right? And you have to get them while no one thinks that that's what their value is. And if you have to pay a little bit more now to get a player who you see, and obviously there's a risk involved here, but that you see evolving into that type of player, I think that's actually a really smart strategy, and I really like that. I mean, Madrid did that with Kovacic, they did it with Vinicius, they've done it with other people. They did it with Ceballos. You get players at a bargain, and then you work with them, and hopefully they develop into the talent that you expect from them.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that completely. I don't have too much to add because I'm honest. Like, I haven't paid attention to Rodrigo. I didn't even know who he was until we signed him. But I will agree with what you said there, and the fact that it's unnecessary pressure to label these kind of guys the new Neymar, Ronaldo, and Messi. But that's just what the media does.
But also, if you look at some of the most successful signings in Madrid's recent history, Marcelo and Higuain, they were both similar to, like, they both came in the winter, so that's a little different, but they were both kids, like real children, signed out of South America. Obviously, Higuain was at River Plate and Marcelo was at Santos, and they barely had played even, but everyone, Madrid trusted in their scouts and in their development, the people that they have over there who are saying, look, these guys are the real deal. So they went ahead and got them and brought them in. And it took a couple years before that they were really showed who they are, but they developed into Marcelo, arguably the best left back ever. And then Higuain, who's been a goal scoring monster for years.
And then I also quickly want to add to that. I mean, I could be wrong because I have no evidence for this, but I think part of the reason we're doing this with exciting young Brazilian wingers is because we don't want to lose out on a chance to get the new Neymar. Because I feel like that really hurt Madrid because lots of rumors that Real Madrid were about to sign him. We had it all wrapped up, and then the whole shenanigans with his dad and Barca came in. Essentially, we lost a player who played a massive role in winning the treble in 14-15, and then the two more league titles.
Yeah, or, I agree.
Or another league title. And, that hurt us. And if Neymar had stayed with Barcelona for longer, the post-Messi era wouldn't have looked so bad.
Yeah.
And now there's rumors we're going to get Neymar back because we kind of have this love affair with him. So I think that's part of the reason we don't want to let Barcelona get their hands on the next hot thing from Brazil. But I could be wrong. That's just a hunch.
I think you're 100% right. I think you can't undervalue or overvalue the impact that losing out on Neymar had on Real Madrid. And the more we learn about it, the more there was probably fraud and there was probably backhanded dealings. And Neymar's dad, I mean, a big part of the reason Neymar went to Barcelona over Real Madrid wasn't about Neymar. The very fact that he would ever come to Real Madrid indicates to me that after playing for Barcelona, coming to Real Madrid means that you always sort of wanted to play for Real Madrid, but someone talked you into playing for Barcelona. And like, I actually kind of get that. Like, all the indications that summer, because I was following it really closely, I was talking to Portuguese experts about, or Brazilian experts about this, was that he himself was always a Real Madrid fan. But his father was negotiating with Barcelona. And Barcelona, I mean, if you actually tabulate the cost of that signing, it was one of the highest ever, if not the highest ever at the time. And that's because about half of it went directly into the pockets of Neymar's father. So yeah, Madrid doesn't want
to. It was some real shady shit. And obviously Real Madrid was not going to be able to top that.
Yeah. All right. Well, so that was a great show. Om, thanks so much for coming on. We'll be back this week with your Patreon VIP shows. I'm sure Kian has people lined up. If not, I will be back with Kian to chat. And if nothing else, Om, it's been great chatting. We'll see you next weekend.
See you as well. Hala Madrid.
Hala Madrid. My chick from Bel Air, my whip from Germany, I'm cooler than LL. I'm sippin' on Bel Air, my chick from Bel Air, my whip from Germany, I'm cooler than LL. I clap my nigga like patty cake, I clap my nigga like patty cake. I'm swaggin', I got flavor, I got soul, call me Ragu. I love my baby girl, pussy ball, call her Caillou. I clap my nigga like patty cake, yeah, that a we. I'm bout to grab the reef, I'm bout to grab the key. Snatch a baby girl and skeet all on her face. I got a feeling that today gon' be a fantastic day. I'm getting tired of that role, I think I won't be teethfully. Is all I win or you lose, cause I wanna self defeat. And everybody wanna have the songs, well I got the recipe. I'm sippin' on Bella cause it made me feel like I'm on ecstasy. I love my baby, when I come home I be rubbing on her feet. And she be always in my chest, she hate when I be in the streets. My rims taller than my son, about to drop another one. You think a nigga in the band the way I hit him with that drum. I'm sippin' on Bella, my chick from Bella, my whip from Germany, I'm cooler than LL. I'm sippin' on Bella, my chick from Bella, my whip from Germany, I'm cooler than LL. I clap my nigga like patty cake, I clap my nigga like patty cake. I'm swaggin', I got flavor, I got soul, call me Ragu. I love my baby girl, pussy ball, call her Caillou. I clap my nigga like patty cake, my chain VVS. I'm booted up, I got more pills than a CVS. Honest shit, baby girl, so I got stains in my jaw. All this money like a nigga hit the fucking paw ball. Sippin' on champagne, my whip on Danny Dane. No time for you lame, I'm flyin' in a plane. I ride like a train, she love to give me brain. You shootin' with your eyes closed, you ain't sniper game. She helped me now when I was gone, I bought her all the marble gear. I love her like I love my brother, so I let her be my connect. I put her thick ass in the vet, tennis bracelet on her neck. You know the code that love the flex, got my mama out the jet. Sippin' on Bel Air, my chick from Bel Air, my whip from Germany, I'm cooler than LL. I'm sippin' on Bel Air, my chick from Bel Air, my whip from Germany, I'm cooler than LL. I clap my nigga like patty cake, I clap my nigga like patty cake. I'm swaggin', I got flavor, I got soul, call me Ragu. I love my baby girl, pussy ball, call her Caillou. I clap my nigga like patty cake.